This is the Pitch Vision My Cricket Coach Show, number 68. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision My Cricket Coach Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com and email us on mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. My name's David Hinchliffe in the UK.
And I'm Kevin Sampath in Australia. Coming up on the show, we have a chat with our batting coach, Gary Palmer. And as usual, we answer your questions for this week. Well, David, we've had a taste of the UK this week. It's been pouring down rain. And I'm starting to know how you guys feel up there.
Yeah, we do get a lot more games rained off than you do. So what happened?
Well, we started our game, David. We batted for about 2 hours really solidly. Our openers got off to a flying start. We were about 85 for no loss. Mm-hmm. And then it just started raining. I think it was because of the rain and maybe a bit of inexperience playing in the rain as well. We lost heaps of quick wickets. And at the end of the day, we had to call it off after 2.5 hours of play. At the end of the day, we were 130 for 7. So we lost 50 runs. We got 50 runs for about 7 wickets. So we lost 7 quick wickets, which was a bit disappointing in the end, but it showed our inexperience in the rain, which is unusual for Australia this time of the year.
When it started to rain, was there a noticeable change in the behaviour of the pitch and the ball?
Yeah, I didn't actually go out there to bat, but everyone coming off said it skidded, but it wasn't the kind of skid that kept low. It was skidding and there was unusual bounce. So some sort of went at a decent pace and at a decent level, but some really came off the pitch at a higher bounce than usual due to the skid. And they were saying it was sort of hard to judge because of the rain as well.
Yeah, and it's not that much fun when you're out in the field either, because there's nowhere to hide. And when you're bowling, the ball's wet and slippery and, you know, you can't grip onto it properly. So It can be the same for both sides. So why do you think the collapse happened? Do you think it was just sort of fear of the conditions or just one of those things?
I think it was just inexperience, David. Our openers, as soon as it started raining, they just played how they were playing before. They were playing their shots, playing aggressively. But as soon as the new batsman came in, everyone just tried to block it out. They're trying to sort of... I think they tried to try a different approach. We had... players who are usually aggressive coming and trying to defend balls that were there to be hit, and they got out due to that. So I think players just thought because it's raining they have to try and alter their game a bit, which you should in the rain, but not completely change someone's game style. What would you suggest, David, if it started raining, would you completely change your game?
I think it does depend, of course it does, it always with these things. I wouldn't say you completely change the game, because especially when you're batting, the rules of batting don't change whatever conditions you're playing in. You know, you still want to look to play straight as much as possible, play the highest percentage shots you can, depending on the game situation.
Yeah.
If it's wet, then you probably want to keep the cross bat shots to a minimum.
Yeah.
Depending on how the pitch is performing, of course. I mean, if it's skidding on a bit, then you might be okay because this ball's coming onto the bat, so you can still pull and cut with safety. But on the grass pitch, especially if it gets wet, it can, and especially when it starts to dry, it can behave in very unusual ways. So you want to play with as tight as technique as you can. That's when it really gets difficult to bat, is when it's rained and then it's starting to dry, and then the pitch starts to behave very unusually. Yeah. But still, I mean, the basic principles of batting apply. You know, you want to build an innings, you know, you want to score, you want to get the feel for what the ball's doing as quickly as possible. And, you know, you might want to be watchful to start with, and as you get your iron, play a bit more. But it's never nice playing in those conditions. It's never nice for anyone. And the good side is that you know that bowlers probably aren't going to be going flat out to bowl at you because they can't. You know, especially with a wet run-up, you don't want to be risking turning your ankle over because you're tearing in. And the spinner, you know, the spinners aren't going to be able to give it as much as a rip as they normally do, and the pitch isn't probably going to be turning as much. So you can turn that to your advantage. You can think to yourself, well, it's going to be harder for the bowlers and, of course, harder for the fielders because the ball's slippery, more chance of dropping it. The ball might be misfielded more often because it's slippery and you can take some quick singles that you wouldn't normally take. So you can look at it from a positive point of view as well. I think it's just as bad for both sides. So, but if it's a beautiful day next week, you could be in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, basically, David, it's going to be a modified one day next week. Since we've already batted 20 and a bit overs, we get to bat 25 overs next week, and the bowling team gets to bat 45 overs. So basically, our captain was telling us our approach would be to bat out our 25 overs to try and get us a defendable total. And yeah. We know that in one days especially, the bowling team usually are very slow to finish their overs.
Yeah.
And if they do that, then they get penalized their batting overs as well. So that and a defendable total, we should be able to sort of claw our way back into the game. But it's not all over yet. Because last time, we nearly defended 110 against this team in a two-dayer. So we're sort of confident at the moment.
Okay, so it's down to you to get your best bowling boots on and put in a good performance when you get the chance to get the ball in your hands.
Yeah, that's right. I think this is the time as well, because we're really fighting for our season. We are sort of out of the finals, but if we do win this game and our next game and a lot of other results go our way, then we still have a mathematical chance of making the final. So we all have that at the back of our heads and try not to put too much pressure on us. We're just trying to have fun at the moment and seeing what happens from there on.
It's a chance to show your character as a team as well, because a good team isn't a team that just wins every week easily.
Yeah.
A good team is a team that they come up against an opposition who are about the same strength as them. They struggle for a portion of the match, but they still come out on top. That's the sign for me of a good team.
Yeah, exactly right, David. And I'm sure character comes with experience as well in our team, which is what we were lacking this season, with a bit of experience. So surely through the season, we've been building on that, learning through our experiences, and hopefully this game will pull in a bit of experience and character will show through as well.
I think so. And you know, you have to work together and you have to do it although it's an individual skills within a team sport, you still have to work together and you have to field well and you have to back each other. And if someone's head goes down, the rest of the team have to bring them back up again. And sometimes it takes someone to put in a good performance individually, but sometimes to get that good individual performance, you need to feel like everyone's backing you all the way.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the advantages of the team that I play in, is that even when someone's having a bad day, that the rest of the team are still behind you and still willing you to do well. And there'll be someone else there who's good enough to take up the slack if you do have a bad day. So you can kind of think to yourself, not relax, but you can think to yourself, okay, well, I'm gonna play well. I might not be playing well this week, but as long as I know I try my hardest, my week will come another week. And until that happens, someone else will be doing the job for me. Which, yeah. I mean, some might say, well, that can be a double-edged sword, because if everybody thinks that, then nobody does the job. But certainly in my team, somebody always seems to put their hand up and say, I'm going to bat through to the end of the innings and get the total we need to win the game, or I'm going to get those important last three wickets, I'm going to bowl out the tail. Whatever it takes, someone always manages to do it. I think Duncan Fletcher coined that phrase, come to the party, which is a bit of a cliche, but it's kind of the sign of a good side when there's always someone who's able to do that.
Well, we're back again to pick the brains of our batting coach, Gary Palmer, who was a first-class cricketer and he played for Somerset. Gary Palmer now helps young players in the game with CCM Academy. So if you want to find out more about Gary Palmer or CCM Academy, please visit www.pitchvision.com/Gary Palmer.
Hi, Gary. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, David.
A bit of a general question this week, so maybe we can try and drill it down a little bit. But it's from a person called Dunn. Don't know whether that's a boy or a girl, but someone called Dunn. And the question is simply, how do I bat against reverse swing bowling?
Basically, all you're asking there is, how do I bat against the in-swinger? Is that what?
It's a pretty short question, so I don't know for sure what they're getting at. But reverse swing is usually held as an away swinger, but it swings in, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I would practice basically on a bowling machine, playing the ball swinging in from over the wicket, and more importantly from round the wicket, because it's far more difficult. You have to have a very good on drive and good positioning to play the on drive to be able to play that swinging ball. And then I would practice the ball swinging away off a machine, also over and around the wicket. Get used to learning how to sort of lean with your head, and as the ball starts swinging, the target area in your mind, because what you initially might think, might for right arm over, swinging in, you might think mid-off. But by the time the ball's got to you and you've waited for it, which you have to do against swing bowling, and you push your head forward and wait, then your shoulders will open and your target area will change. It'll probably become more mid-on. So you've got to learn to wait for the ball, play it later. You have to be impeccable at playing the on drive to play the ball that's swinging either way really well. And that would be my starting point.
And if you are in a position where someone is reversing the ball to you, then do you think it's easier to be deceived, because you may see it coming down and think it's going to swing away?
Do you know what, David? You're going to laugh at this. It's making me feel old talking to you, because I don't think I've ever faced anyone who told me a reverse swinger. I've been lucky enough to face people like Richard Hadley that sort of swing it away, swing it back into you, Malcolm Marshall, yeah, they can do it at will. Mm-hmm. But I've never faced reverse swing. So I can't really comment on what you would do. But the answer I've given about learning to play the swinging ball will be what helps that player cope with it when it's reversing.
I know some people who have faced it say that they don't even bother to look for seam position or anything like that, because there's no point, because it could swing either way anyway. So you just watch the ball as closely as you can and play it, whether, you know, if it swings in, then just play it as an in-swinger.
The bottom line is, if your coach has coached you well to play through the V, both front and back foot, that coach has given you the tools to use against the swinging ball. So if you've got good basic technique and you have an awareness of waiting for the ball and knowing how to hit with the swing, you know, it doesn't matter what it's in swing, out swing, reverse swing, you've got the tools to deal with it and cope with it.
Thank you, Gary, for your time. If you want to find out more about Gary Palmer and his coaching and CCM Academy, please visit www.pitchvision.com/Gary Palmer. Welcome to the question section for this week. David, our first question is from Damien, and it's about choosing the right bat, David. Damien plays in Norway, David, and he says, coming from Australia, I've always used a light bat. I'm more of a run accumulator. However, in Norway, where I'm playing at the moment, the outfields are very heavy and I'm stronger than I used to be. Is there an actual ideally weighted bat for each player, where you can get the perfect balance between the maneuverability and bat speed of a light bat on one hand and the power of a heavy bat? Or is it just a matter of choosing a bat and getting used to it? Now, David, I know international players have heavy bats and light bats, but us club players sometimes can't afford that luxury. Is there actually a method of seeing anywhere in the middle between the lightness of a bat and the heaviness of a bat, that sweet weight for a bat?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, actually. Sort of where does it all fit together? I think the first thing to bear in mind is when you're talking about the weight of the bat, is it too heavy? Because if you use a bat that's too heavy, you're not going to be able to play shots properly with it. You're just going to be hefting it around all the time. So you want a bat which is when you pick it up in your dominant hand, your top hand. So if you're right-handed batsman, left hand. If you pick it up in your left hand, and you hold it out to the side. So you hold it at the end of the handle, and hold it out to the side, as if you're signalling a no ball with your left hand. Then you should be able to move the bat so you're pointing it forwards and then moving it back sideways again without it feeling heavy and without your arm shaking or anything like that. If you get your arm shaking or the bat starts to drop as you do it, it's probably too heavy. You want a lighter bat. But yeah. For most, certainly for adult players anyway, you can probably get quite a heavy bat to do that. So the question, once you know you can do that, the question is then, how does it feel when you pick it up? And as you say, Kev, you know, you go into the shop, you pick it up, how does it feel? Yeah, this feels better than this one. You can't really put your finger on it. It's just kind of the balance of it feels right to you. You know, there's no mathematical formula to say, you know, if you are such and such a player, you should have a 2-pound 8-ounce bat, and if you're another sort of player, you should have a 2-pound 12-ounce bat, or you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would say, the other important thing I would say when you're picking it, when you're choosing a bat, not to worry too much about the weight at all, but just worry about the quality of the wood that you've got, because a cashmere willow isn't going to be as good as a top starred English willow bat, for example. So within the budget that you've got for buying a bat, I'd say don't really think about what the weight is, but think about what the pickup is and how good a quality of willow can you get for your money. And if you can get a better quality bat that hasn't quite got the perfect pickup, I'd probably go for the better quality bat that hasn't quite got the perfect pickup than the worst quality bat that has got the perfect pickup. That's probably the way I'd judge it.
Yeah.
The other thing that you probably want to think about is where the position in the middle of the bat is. Some bats specifically have a lower middle, some specifically have a higher middle. Again, not critical. It wouldn't be a deal breaker if I had a bat with a high middle and I know I bat on low slow pitches, but everything else was perfect about it, then I'd just get the one with the high middle, because the middle's in roughly the same place all the time. So in other words, don't worry about it too much. Pick a bat that feels right to you, get the highest quality wood that you can get your hands on, and go and practice with it as much as you can until it feels like a rapier in your hand.
Yes. Right, David, our next question is from Matharan, and he says, I have trouble looking at the ball until it hits the face of my bat. I tend to watch the ball until it bounces and then not look at it until I hit it. Does anyone have any tips or advice for me so I can watch the ball until it hits my bat? David, I don't know who said this. I'm not sure, but one of the top coaches said that it's almost impossible to watch the ball right onto the bat, but you can try your best, but there's a point in the delivery where your eyes stop looking at the ball and sort of reacts to it. Is that true, David?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's there was research done by two chaps called Landon McLeod, who tracked what top batsmen and not so top batsmen eyes do when they're watching the ball. And what they found out was, as opposed to the normal sort of coaching mantra of watch the ball right onto the bat, it was impossible to do that. What the top batsmen did was they watched the ball early on in its flight. Then they, somewhere early on in the flight, they calculated roughly where the ball was going to bounce, and then they moved their eyes to that point. Well, this all happens in fractions of a second. We're talking about milliseconds. It all happens, but they shift their eyes to where they think the ball is going to pitch, and then they pick up the ball when it comes back into their eye line in the expected area that is going to bounce. So you can't watch the ball onto the bat, and in fact the better the batsman, the quicker they took their eye off the ball, because they'd picked up the line and the length of the ball earlier than the lesser batsmen take longer to pick up line and length of the ball. That's one of the key things that distinguish between a good batsman and an average batsman, is how quickly you pick up the line and the length of the ball.
So it's all about judging the ball rather than actually watching it.
So it's all about how quickly you can pick up the line of the length and judge where it's going to pitch, and then how quickly you can move your eyes to that position. Because the quicker you can do that, the quicker you can select your shot, and the more chance you have of executing it correctly. Obviously you still have to select the right shot. That's the next portion of it, and then the last part, which is you have to perform the shot as good as possible, and the ball has to hit the middle of the bat. But you can't do any of that without taking your eye off the ball, which is a strange thing to say. Of course, if you're talking about coaching somebody, then you can't tell them to watch the ball for the first 0.14 of a second, and then take your eye off the ball and look where it's going to pitch. That's not no one's going to be able to consciously do that. So what you really have to say to somebody is watch the ball as closely as you can and try and pick up the line and the length as quickly as possible. That's really what you've got to try and do. Which leads on to one of our most common questions is how do I pick up the line and the length as early as possible?
Yeah.
Now that is one of those golden questions that I think maybe I've been asked it a lot and I've looked into it a lot. And I think maybe it's one of those things that is genetically determined. So although you can improve where you are, I think if you're Viv Richards, you're going to be always going to be better at picking up the line and the length of the ball than if you're an average club player.
Yeah.
You know, it was said of Bradman, one of the things that was said of him that made him such a good batsman was that he seemed to know where the ball was going to be before it had been bowled. And what that says to me is that he was just very, very good at picking up the line and the length of delivery very, very early. And that's what made him, well, one of the things that made him such a great batsman. And I think something like that is just, it's just hardwired into your brain. So, but we've gone a bit off track there. But if we go back to the point, which is, I can't watch the ball onto the bat. Don't. I mean, the real question is, what problem is that causing you? Are you selecting the wrong shot? Are you selecting the right shot, but you're not playing it properly? What's the problem that not watching the ball onto the bat is causing you? So that's the key question, because you can't watch the ball onto the bat. So there must be an underlying problem there. But it's an interesting thing to talk about, because you can't. I mean, it's not something you can do consciously. So, and there's not really any way you can coach somebody to do it better, apart from just to have them in the net facing bowling the ball over and over again until you get used to the idea of it.
David, our last question for today is from Narita, who asks, I would like to know if cricketers are advised to eat jelly babies or chewing sugary sweets before or after the game. Does it help with their energy? David, I know international players do this, but international players have a massive workload with 5-day tests, a massive day, plus another 4 days after that. So is it really necessary for club cricketers to have sugary sweets before games and after games, or do they just have to eat right, like their normal foods before and after the games?
Well, it depends. How much do you want to make the ball swing artificially? Because you can put sugary saliva on the ball, can't you, if you're eating jelly babies all day? it's a bit of a yes and no thing, this. Jelly babies will, or any kind of sugary sweets, will give you energy because sugar gives you energy. And you'll get a short burst of energy from the sugar, like an instant burst of energy from the sugar. It won't suddenly make you Superman for 15 minutes or anything. It'll probably be more like it'll stave off tiredness for a little bit longer. But there are downsides to that. First, that tiredness comes from lots of different things, not just how much energy you've got. It also comes from your central nervous system. So if your central nervous system is telling you to pack it in, it doesn't matter how many sugary sweets you eat. Your brain is telling you, I've had enough. Stop doing whatever you're doing. In this case, playing cricket. That's why you get that kind of heavy leg feeling that you can't shake off towards the end of the day. It's not because you haven't got any fuel left in the tank. There's probably plenty of fuel left in the tank. It's just that your body is trying to protect itself. It's starting to feel tired, so it's saying, the brain is sort of taking over and the safety mechanism is trying to click in and it's stopping you from going at full pelt anymore. So jelly babies aren't going to make any difference to that. And the other side is, if you eat quite a lot of jelly babies, then you could have a sugar crash, which you end up feeling completely drained. And then you have to have more jelly babies to get yourself back up again to where you were, and you're suddenly in this up and down spiral through the whole of the day. So, yeah. So that's the downside of it. Of course, the other downside is that it's not very healthy. You know, it's not very good for your teeth. It's not very good for it's not very good for you to have too much sugar in your diet. You know, you could put on weight, especially if you're not playing cricket professionally and training in the gym every day, or playing cricket every day, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
If you spend your afternoon standing at slip munching jelly babies, and you don't run around very much, you don't bowl, and then you know you bat number four, and the opener's knocked the score off, and then all you've done is stand in a field eating jelly babies. So I probably wouldn't recommend it to me. I wouldn't stop people doing it if it motivates them, or it helps them feel like they can get through the day with it. You know, it helps the bowler get through his last bowling spell or whatever, then I'm not going to stop him. But I probably would say, if anyone asked me, should I, my advice would be, look at your whole diet overall. You know, make sure that you're getting your food from healthy whole sources rather than those kind of processed sugary sources, because you can get the same results from a banana you can from a handful of jelly babies, but the banana is a source of natural sugar, and it's got loads of vitamins and minerals in it, things that can do you good as well as just sort of give you that energy burst. You don't have to eat like a monk, but there's some foods that are more nutritionally dense than others, and if you're going for a certain result, then you might as well go for the more nutritionally dense ones than the ones that have very little nutritional value apart from giving you an energy burst. And the other thing is that, probably as a side note to all that, is that there's a bit of a tradition with cricketers. They feel like they need to load up on carbs on either the morning of the match or the day before the match. Do you ever get people talking about that?
Yeah, David, I heard that a lot of times. I used to do that as well a couple of years back when I used to play juniors. I'd eat heaps of carbs the night before.
The theory goes that if you eat carbs, you get energy, right? Carbs give you energy, so therefore I need to eat a load of carbs. And that's the sort of thing that marathon runners do. Before they run a marathon, they eat a massive bowl of pasta or whatever. It's a bit different with cricket, because cricket is an intermittent activity. So you don't get that sort of steady release of energy that you do, say, if you're in the Tour de France or you're running a marathon. So it's a bit different. You don't need as much energy from carbohydrates as you think you do. Some people can get away with it because they've got a certain body type that they can handle carbohydrates more easily. But most people, the more especially starchy and processed carbohydrates you eat, the more likely you are to put on unneeded weight. So I'm not saying cut out carbs. I'm not saying eat an Atkins diet or anything like that. But you probably don't need to carb load. You probably just need to have a healthy all-round diet, plenty of fruit, plenty of vegetables, plenty of lean protein, plenty of healthy fats, and a few sort of starchy carbohydrates from whole sources. And then the whole issue of whether you should eat jelly babies or not just becomes irrelevant, because you don't need them. You just don't need them.
You can get more information, tips, advice, and tricks on our website at www.pitchvision.com. The site is updated daily and includes forums to chat with other cricketers around the world. You can also subscribe to the My Cricket Coach show for free on iTunes, or you can click the link on the show's page that will take you directly to iTunes to subscribe. Stay tuned for our next show on the 19th of February. So if you want to get in touch or have any questions, you can email us at mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. That's mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you next time. So from Sydney, Australia, this is Kevin Sampad signing off.
And this is David Hinchliffe in the UK.